coming up.
Today I wanted to talk about siblings.
Who has a right to limit the number of children anyone can have?
For 35 years, to control population growth, the Chinese government permitted each family to have a maximum of one child. No siblings.
Overpopulation is going to have catastrophic consequences. Don't we have a duty to have fewer children?
Does anyone have a right to have children?
For years, while we were all watching 19 kids and counting, China could only tune into one child and we are content.
The government can't conscript me into having children. How can it forbid me from having children?
If the world is rapidly becoming overpopulated, can we at least talk about population control?
Our guest is Sarah Conley, author of One Child, Do We Have a Right to More?
Is having children a right or a privilege?
One child, too many.
Coming up on Philosophy Talk.
Hey, philosopher, thanks for downloading this episode of Philosophy Talk.
And thank you for being a Philosophy Talk partner.
We're grateful for your past support. We need you to stand up and help us again, now more than ever. And you can do so just by heading over to the Philosophy Talk webpage and clicking that big I Will Help button. And believe me, it will really help.
Thank you for listening.
Thank you for thinking.
And thank you for donating.
Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. We're here at the studios of KALW San Francisco.
Continuing conversations that begin at Philosopher's Corner at Stanford, where Ken teaches philosophy and I did for 40 years.
40 memorable years, I hope, John. Now, today's episode is One Child Too Many.
One too many? There are way too many children on this earth, Ken.
That's why we're asking whether people nowadays really have the right to have as many children as they want.
Of course not. There are 7.3 billion people on the planet already. There'll be 11 billion by the end of the century. Our poor Earth is groaning and cracking under the weight of us humans.
Are you suggesting that we should let the human race gradually die out or whittle itself down to size or something?
I do not advocate human extinction.
Oh, God. Well, thank God for that, John. Jeez.
But we do have to manage the world's population or get it to manage itself. We've got way past the time when everyone can just have as many kids as they want and the earth be damned.
Well, okay, but just how do you propose that we do that, manage the world's population?
Well, I mean, China had a certain amount of success with its one-child policy, thanks to that. It is no longer the world's most populous country. That dubious honor now belongs to India, or at any rate, it soon will.
Well, but China, John, China's a brutal, totalitarian dictatorship. They were willing to resort to mandatory abortions and forced sterilization to endorse that policy at times. You know, you'd never, ever in your wildest dreams be able to pull that kind of thing off in a democracy like ours.
Well, maybe Japan is a better model. The most rapid decline in population in human history. And not because of government coercion, but because of changing social mores. Women decide on their own they don't want marriage and kids, not to mention in-laws.
That's right.
In fact, the government is doing everything it can to combat this trend, but it's not working.
Well, but look at what Japan's rapid population decline has done to its once dynamic economy. Japan, a few decades ago, was one of the world's economic engines. Now it's one of the economic laggards in the world. Is that what you want to see?
No, but I think economists need to figure out some way to wean us from depending on population growth as a condition for prosperity. I mean, the lazy guys, I mean, they're giving us the easy theories. They need to work on the hard stuff. Even in this country, by the way, we do everything in our power to discourage certain people from having children already.
Now you sound like an old-fashioned eugenicist or something. What are you talking about?
No, I'm not talking about some racial group. I'm talking about an age group. Teenagers, nobody, not even you, can. Thinks that immature, hormonally swamped teenagers should reproduce willy-nilly.
Well, okay, you got me there, but...
Frankly, if you ask me, every teenage boy should be required to have a fail-safe reversible vasectomy at puberty. They can reverse it when they reach 21 or 25 or maybe 45 when they're old enough to make rational decisions.
Well, John, then I just won't ask you, okay? I won't ask you.
Okay, well, don't ask, okay. In fact, did you know that the teenage birth rate in this country is actually at an all-time low, even without my idea? That's thanks to easy access to contraceptives and abortion, fueled by the rise of the internet, which gives teenagers information in spite of what their parents may not want them to know, plus better sex education, in some places at least, along with widespread change in sexual attitudes and behaviors among the young.
Well, I gotta admit, that's a good thing.
Yeah, good for the kids themselves, good for society at large, and good for the earth.
But teenagers, come on, they're a special case. There are lots of things that we don't let them do. But I want to see you try telling married adult couples who are financially stable, reasonably rational, how many kids they can't and can't have. Come on, let me see you do that. How far do you think you'd get with that, John?
Well, pretty far, actually. I'd say, look, you two, I empathize with your desire to have a big family. And at least you're able to handle it and educate it. So, you know, but really, the world can't afford a lot more population or even what we got. So you got one natural kid, delightful child. If you want more, why don't you just adopt?
Well, but if they told you to bug off and mind your own business, what'd you say then?
Well, I handle that kind of rejection well, Ken. You mean like if they were complete narcissists with no sense of shared responsibility for the world? Then we might have to treat them the way we treat smokers, subject them to public shaming, forced education, higher taxes, stuff like that, but only as a last resort.
Oh, wow, yeah. Big families as smokers, right. I think you're way overestimating the civic-mindedness of people, for one thing, and not to mention the amount of haranguing they're willing to put up with from do-gooder know-it-alls like you or even the government. Come on, John.
Well, I didn't say it was going to be easy. This is no doubt a many-sided issue.
And to show us two of the many sides of this issue, we sent our roving philosophical reporter, Shukin Kalantari, to speak with one person who loves having lots of kids and another one who has gone to great lengths to have none. She files this report.
When Matt Leonard was 21 years old, he decided to get a vasectomy.
I was drawn to it. I looked into it. I contacted easily a half dozen other doctors and clinics, and pretty much everyone flatly rejected me just on the phone with basic questions of how old are you and do you already have children?
Leonard says most doctors won't give you a vasectomy if you aren't 30 and don't already have kids. So 6 years later, he moved to San Francisco and tried again. This time he lied.
I lied through my teeth and was able to say, yes, I've been in a long-term committed relationship for over 10 years, which was not true. That my parents were both on board and they weren't concerned about grandchildren, that I had siblings who had other children. None of this was true.
Leonard knew he didn't want to have kids since he was a teen. He says he wasn't into kinship relationships, but mostly he hated the idea of contributing to overpopulation and the overuse of resources.
By simply being in the global north, the amount of resources that we consume dwarfs that of many other parts of the world.
Leonard works for the environmental group 350.org and believes the dialogue around overpopulation has become a slippery slope, especially when you look at the history of forced sterilization around the world.
And I think those are very awful realities of what arguments around overpopulation have led people to pursue. But I think the reality is that we can't then shy away from the discussion about overpopulation because of that awful history. We still need to grapple with it in a very real way.
It's been 10 years since Matt Leonard got his vasectomy, and he doesn't regret it. He gets to focus all his time and energy on environmental justice issues instead of raising kids. But he does have one concern.
While I've watched my parents get older and move into retirement, I've seen that burden that's fallen on me to sort of care for them as an only child is difficult, it's challenging. And I do sort of have pause of, well, what'll happen to me when I'm at that age? Who will take care and care for me?
I'm dealing with this now because I have a 100-year-old grandmother who's at home and not in the best of shape at the moment.
Julie Cole is from Ontario, Canada, and comes from a pretty big family.
We all take turns, her children, her grandchildren, and her great-grandchildren. We take shifts going in to see her and take care of her, and it's the many hands make light work.
Cole has six kids. Her oldest is 16, and her youngest is 7.
probably the most difficult person to tell when I was expecting my sixth was actually my old Irish Catholic granny, because she would grab my arm and say, "You girls don't have to do this anymore. You have choices."
Cole says she's happy with her choice to have a large family, but she knows a lot of people think it's environmentally irresponsible.
There was some very colorful feedback about how I'm single-handedly taking down Mother Earth, me and my spawn.
Cole says she's actually conscious of curbing her family's carbon footprint. She teaches her kids how to garden, recycle, compost. They pack trash-free lunches. And all their clothes and toys are hand-me-downs.
There's so many things we can do to teach children about environmental stewardship.
Cole says she doesn't think everybody should have half a dozen kids, or any kids at all. They could be child-free for all she cares.
You know, my expression is, you know, people say mind your own business. I always say mind your own uterus. You know, everybody take care of your own reproductive choices. They exist for a reason. Women have fought hard for them. I don't believe in shaming families of any size. I don't believe in calling childless couples selfish.
Julie Cole has six children. Matt Leonard is so against having children that he got a vasectomy when he was 27. Cole and Leonard may live completely different lifestyles, but the two aren't that different. They both agree that parenthood should be your own choice. Do the best you can with the information you have. Try to get more information. Or as Julie Cole says, mind your own uterus. For Philosophy Talk, I'm Shuka Kalantari.
Thanks, Shuka, for that interesting report. I'm John Perry. With me is my fellow Stanford philosopher, Ken Taylor.
And today it's One Child Too Many. Should people be free to have as many children as they choose? We're joined now by Sarah Conley. She's a professor of philosophy at Bowdoin College. She's author of One Child, Do We Have a Right to More? Sarah, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Thank you for letting me join you.
Hi, Sarah. So tell us how you got into this topic. Worries about the environment, personal experience? I don't suppose you just don't like kids.
I love kids. You know, this is a topic where it seems to me the question isn't how did you get interested in it? The question is how could you not be interested in it? And some philosophers study esoteric things that are hard to understand for anyone, you know, why you'd be interested. But in this case, every day in the paper, we read about some new environmental disaster. And again, if we read more widely, we know that overpopulation is the primary reason for that.
So you are willing to avoid absorbing and trendy topics like higher order quantifiers in order to think about this pressing social problem.
Yeah.
Good for you. I admire your choice there. So let's see if you can do a little better than I did earlier. You're talking to a young couple. They're rational, environmentally concerned. They want to do the right thing. They have one child already, but for various different reasons, they really, really want a second child. How could you persuade them to not do that?
I'd say three things. One, think about the life that second child will have. At present, the United Nations projects that there will be a population of 9.7 billion by the year 2050, which is obviously within the lifetime of children born today. No one is exactly sure what life on the planet will be like with 9.7 billion, but they're all sure it will be bad. It's not a pretty picture. Second, I'd say think about other people. Of course, you're concerned about your child's future, but we have to consider the effect that all these children are having on everyone. We're all going to be in the same boat, and it's going to be really, really painful. Third, I'd say think about yourself. When you look at your first child, you say, I can't imagine life without this child. If someone took this child away, I would be devastated. And that's true. No one wants to take away the children you have. But you aren't devastated by the loss of the children you don't have. You don't think I could have had a fourth child, a fifth child, a sixth child. How awful that I don't have them.
Sarah,
we don't.
I get the rationality of your arguments. I do. I do. And I do think you did better than John in our opening. I think that's a powerful line of argument. But I don't know. Having the decision to have kids isn't a calculation of the globe, what I will contribute or not contribute to the global well-being by this. It's a potentially personnel, shaping my life course, having things that I have this special kind of... I mean, once you realize how much you love your children when you have them, when they're not abstracta, but they're concrete realities, and the joy of loving, and I mean, for some people it's not, but that loving is a deeply fulfilling thing. I mean, global, abstract, rational considerations, how do they weigh against that?
Well, the thing about having the huge population we do is that it means personal decisions aren't just personal. Because now there are so many of us so close together, what you do has an impact on other people. And it's just selfish to say, I'm not going to think about anyone else. I'm just going to do what I personally want to do.
So also, I would say in response to Ken that some of these things aren't really just abstract anymore. They're happening, and we can see them on TV. I don't know to what extent global warming is responsible for all the terrible disruptions in the climate, but I'm sure a lot of it, and that's causing lots of people to have to move and migrate, and it all is exacerbated by having too many people.
I grant you both are making good points, but I don't know. I think I'm going to come back to my point after we take a break, because I don't think the personal and the political and the global are so easily like run together. I just don't think it's that simple in human psychology. But you're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today, we're thinking about whether having children, one or more, is a right or a privilege or just morally wrong. We're thinking about that with Sarah Conley from Bowdoin College.
What do you think? Should people procreate as much as they want? If not, then how do we get them to stop? We'll dig into this in the next segment.
Overpopulation versus overregulation, when Philosophy Talk continues.
Does the earth grin or groan with every birth? I'm John Perry. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor. We're thinking about whether having multiple children is a right, a privilege, or a grave moral wrong.
Our guest is Sarah Conley from Bowdoin College, author of One Child, Do We Have a Right to More?
So, Sarah, I want to pick up on the question of rights a little bit. I mean, you could persuade, when you were trying to persuade this couple, our imaginary couple, you cited lots of, let's call them prudential considerations and some moral considerations, right? But a right is something that, I mean, that woman in the roving report who has six kids said, mind your own uterus, right? It implied, she didn't say it, but it implied she has kind of an absolute dominion over her own uterus. The government can't interfere. I mean, you can advise her or encourage her, but she has a right to decide for herself. What would you say to her to say, no, you don't. You don't have such a right.
I would say she doesn't have a right because of the effect she's going to have on other people. So we generally think rights are bounded, are limited by the amount of harm the exercise of an activity might do. So we say we have a right to free speech. Good, we do. But we also say you don't have a right to yell fire in a crowded theater. Why? Because it does too much harm. So generally, when we think about rights, we can't just say, well, we used to have this right, or this is something I really like. We think this is something I do really want, and it's important to me, but I can't insist I can do it when that will do great harm to others.
But there seems to be a difference there. When you shout fire in a crowded theater, the picture is that you cause harm right then. That wouldn't have happened if you hadn't shouted fire. But when you have something where the individual harm that any decision is going to have is kind of statistically insignificant, it's a little bit harder to picture it this way, isn't it? I mean, any particular couple is going to have one more child, it's really not going to make any difference. How do you persuade them that they ought to be guided by what would happen if everybody did the same when they know that everybody isn't going to do the same?
Well, it's true. If I'm the only person who's trying to limit how many children I have, it's not going to do any good. What we need is coordination across societies, so that you know that when you do this, when you restrain yourself, other people will do it too. And there are a lot of ways we can do that, from education to incentives like contraception, and finally to laws, if that's what it takes.
So let me try something on you, though. So I think this is interesting. I mean, suppose we were behind something like the Rawlsian veil of ignorance, you know, where we're going to ground a society and all that. And we didn't, I don't know if we know about the world's population or not. Let's suppose we don't know about the world's population.
So just say a little more about what the veil of ignorance is.
We're starting a society from scratch. We're trying to distribute burdens and responsibilities fairly. We don't know who's going to be in what situation of life, and we're just legislating kind of from this behind this veil of ignorance how we should live our lives together without being it tied to our individual interests, but kind of structures of fair cooperation and stuff like that. Okay, but so, I mean, we say, yeah, if the world's popular, I mean, doesn't it seem like we start out with a kind of a dominion over our own body, over our own uteruses, if we're women, and yeah, we could agree to a scheme in which the state is allowed to do certain things but not other things, but we start out with some kind of self-ownership, some kind of self-dominion, some kind of autonomy, and we legislate from this position of autonomy, so we'd have to give up the right to procreate freely, wouldn't we? It's not something that we have to earn. It's something that the state has to be granted.
Well, again, the right to control our own bodies is the right to control it up to a point. If I want to send my fist into your nose and I say, hey, it's my fist, I can do that.
Yeah.
You would say, well, wait a minute. You know, your right to swing your fist ends at the other man's nose. Everyone would agree to that.
Yeah, that goes back to John Stuart Mill.
What I am able to do with my body is important. It's very important. But that doesn't mean it's absolutely unlimited and that I can do whatever I want, no matter how much it hurts other people.
Sarah, I get you. But I think John was making a really good point, and I was kind of trying to expand on it, but I did a really bad job. Because, look, it's one thing for me to harm you. It's another thing for me to do something that you disapprove of, or maybe even shifts a burden onto you that you might not otherwise have. I don't know if a mere shifting of a burden is a harm. So if I have 6 kids, now there's a burden on you if you want to care about this to have fewer kids. Is that a harm, or is that merely a shifting of burden? Now, is all shifting of burdens from one person to another, from one group to another, is all of that harm? And so can all of that be regulated by the harm principle that you're applying to?
Well, it depends on the weight of the burden specifically. You know, is this a burden, so-called, that's going to make you unable to live a fulfilled life? In that case, I would say, yeah, it is a harm. So if the burden I'm shifting is the burden of living in a place with, you know, disastrous weather and not enough fresh water and not enough topsoil for food and so forth, then instead of saying, well, sorry I made your life a little harder, I think we'd say, I harmed you by taking away the wherewithal for living a decent life.
So I mean, I'm pretty sympathetic, but I think it might be better to focus on impact rather than burden, because I think most people don't think about that. I mean, particularly teenage boys. And girls too, but I mean, you know, when you have a child, in the first place, that some woman has gone through 9 months of labor, that's not all that pleasant, even if it has its rewards. And then you've got this huge thing. I mean, it's going to grow into, you know, a couple hundred pounds, 6 foot tall, possibly. And it's going to be, I mean, as I get older, I mean, I'm only 74, same age as, or 73, I don't know how old I am. In this day and age, I'm going to clutter up this planet for another 20 years unless I step in front of a car or something. I've been around for a long time. It's a very consequential decision that my parents made, or probably didn't make. So impact, and then from impact, maybe you can get to burden. But just if people thought about the impact they were making. But
Right.
If you tell people that, they'll say, yeah, that's true in general. But my kid is going to be smart, intelligent, and contribute so much to the world that they'll more than make up for that. What do you say to those people?
I think we heard the lady with six children saying that she was trying to be environmentally responsible, so she packs lunches with no waste. Great. The problem is that even if you live a very responsible life, so you wear the hand-me-downs, you pack lunches with no waste, you recycle your lunch bags, none of that catches up to the impact you have by having a child. So your child would no doubt be the smartest, most talented, loveliest kid that ever lived. That doesn't mean that, you know, we're gaining on the whole, because each of us thinks that way. Each of us thinks our child is the smartest, loveliest, and so forth. And we each think that, and we each have a child or many children. And then we have overpopulation.
Yeah, I see a day coming. Tell me if I'm right. I see a day coming in which, back to our opening, in which people with large families will be regarded the way we kind of regard smokers. We've got to contain them, shame them, educate them, discourage them in every way possible.
No, you're talking about cigarette smokers or pipe smokers.
No,
you don't want to, you know, paint with too white a brush here again.
Do you see such a day coming? I mean, it feels like such a day is coming.
I am not a real fan of shame as a way of changing people. I think there are a lot of things that are preferable. So John said we can educate people about sex. Well, always a good idea no matter what situation you're in. We can also educate people about population.
Yeah.
I hear from a lot of people who say, there's just no problem. The global fertility rate, that is the number of children a woman has in her lifetime, has dropped. And they're right, it has dropped. But this fact has not escaped the experts at the UN who say we're going to have a population of 11.2 billion by 2100.
Well, yeah, that's a lot of people.
Even though the fertility rate has dropped, we're still expecting this huge increase. And we're not just expecting it like maybe it could happen. That is what will happen if we continue the way we are going.
But listening to
think how many of those are going to be philosophy majors.
Well, there you go. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're talking about one child too many. We'd love to have you join this conversation. Phil in San Rafael is on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Phil.
Thank you. Good morning, John, Ken. In my opinion, it seems like one of the biggest problems are other cultures, the effect that other cultures have on our society. For instance, it's a daily occurrence where I'm from to see a woman pushing a double baby carriage with one hand holding, or not hand necessarily, but with a young four-year-old boy, let's say, on her left, flanking on her left-hand side, and a three-year-old girl on her right-hand side, and multiply this times, I don't know how many, walking to and from school every day. And it just tells me that they are not getting the message, and we are not educating them when they enter the country or thereafter, you know.
Well, Phil, I don't know. Thanks for the call. Sarah, are we actually, I mean, in the U.S., we're trying to drive down teenage birth rates, but we're not delivering a message in a systematic way. But there's people like you, but like the government and policymakers, are they trying to deliver the message to the U.S. population, have fewer children?
No, because it's unpopular. And as we know, politicians, at least usually, try to be popular. So, yeah, it's not a particular culture. It's not, you know, an anti-immigration message. The message is simply, we need to recognize how much harm this is doing.
So let me
and again, we need to do other things like making contraception easily available, maybe giving tax breaks for having fewer children or tax penalties for having more. But the government is essential for all those efforts.
Yeah, let me ask you a question about, so some people say this is a third world problem, not a first world problem. I mean, we talked about the case of Japan, right? And we talked to, and we didn't mention this, that as I understand it, except for immigration, The U.S. would either have a stagnant birth rate or a stagnant population or a declining population. So it's immigration that keeps the U.S. growing. I think the same is true of Germany. I think its birth rate among German citizens is below replacement, and this is true in lots of places in the first world. So isn't this, I mean, I don't think you can isolate it to the third world, but the third world, because people migrate and we have a massive migration of people around the globe, so it's the world's problem. But, I mean, birth rates in the developed world are kind of low and in the developing world are kind of high. And could we impose, if we were to impose lower birth rates on the developing world, wouldn't they object to that strongly?
Well, I think you answered your own question. That is, we're not talking about first world versus third world. There is only one world. And people move all around it and will continue to do so naturally in the pursuit of a good life. Now, does that mean I think that we, who, Americans, philosophers, should impose limits on people in, say, Uganda, which has a fairly high fertility rate? No. But one of the things we could do, we coming from a rich country, is make contraception more available. Because there's a huge unmet need. Not surprisingly, the places with the highest fertility rates are the places with the least access to doctors and the least access to contraception. So we could do that. We're not going to declare a dictatorship. But if we could help people meet their own needs in terms of family planning, I don't see the harm that would be done.
Now, isn't another variable women's education? I mean, that the more women have rights and are educated, the lower the birth rate?
Absolutely. Women's education, general economic development, women's participation in the workforce. But the causal factor goes both ways. That is, it's easier for a woman to be in the workforce if she has fewer children than if she has a lot. So we certainly want to encourage women's education. I mean, regardless of anything else we're talking about,
right,
we want to encourage that.
Maria, Northern California, if you're brief, we'll get your question in. We may get the answer after the break. Welcome to Philosophy
Okay,
Talk.
Well, I just wanted to relay a story. When I was in India in 77, I saw a line of young men lined up to go in this doorway, and I was curious because there was no women and children. They weren't getting food. And so I went over and talked to them, and they said, oh, they're giving us transistor radios for a vasectomy. And I later on, I thought, these look like really poor people, and how are they going to buy batteries? And anyway, I just thought that was an interesting way to control population.
So, Sarah, really briefly, you want to respond to that? We have to go to a break, but you have a brief response to that?
Giving someone something sort of small, like a radio, undercuts the seriousness of the issue. And I think that's why we don't like it. It acts as if this isn't a big deal. And it is a big deal to get a vasectomy. But, the fact that it's a big deal doesn't mean it's something we shouldn't do. It is something we really need to do
so
generally.
So you think if we gave them something more valuable to reflect the value of the vasectomy, would that be a good thing? A more valuable incentive?
I think generally that, we know how many children people have is sensitive to finances. So when I think of the U.S., which I know better than India, I do think things like tax penalties and tax incentives would make a difference, because we know that whenever you have less money, you have fewer children, when you have contraception.
Right. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're thinking about the right to procreate. Our guest is Sarah Conley, author of One Child, Do We Have a Right to More?
If life on Earth will change drastically for the worse unless population is controlled, it seems like we ought to do something. But what? We'll look at the options in the next segment.
Procreation, population, and pollution. When Philosophy Talk continues.
Well, we've heard from Paul Simon, and now we've heard from Paul McCartney. What more authority do we need to conclude that we got too many people, period? What can we do about overpopulation? get people to stop having kids, I guess. I'm John Perry. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor. Our guest is Sarah Conley, author of One Child, Do We Have a Right to More? And we're thinking about whether having children is a right, a privilege, or perhaps a grave moral wrong. So we've got a caller in the line, Marie-Louise from Palo Alto. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Marie-Louise.
Thank you very much. Good morning.
What's your comment or question?
My thought is a lot of points of very good points have already been made, but I'm thinking that if there were such a thing as to limit the people to have one child, I think it would be a worthwhile idea to have some kind of board of health where people can those who wish to have another child could somehow prove it to the board that in their case it would be a good thing to have another child. And so I think that that could be a good idea. It's too abrupt to go from whatever number to just one child. And some people, I think, are good parents and can do it well. So that is my point. I would have more, but I don't think you have time for it.
Okay, Marie-Louise, thanks for the question. I'm going to press this question to you, Sarah, with a little more edge, because it underlies something that I think some people have the fear of here. My wife is reading this book, Imbeciles, about the eugenics movement, which is an ugly chapter in American history. Mm-hmm. The Board of Health, where you go to get approval, that's the thing. You know, I can imagine it deciding, well, the black people don't get to have more kids. We need, on average, one kid per couple. Well, the rich, white, middle class, upper middle class, and the black people, and the dumb people, and the this people, and the, I mean, there's this fear underneath some of this. I mean, what do you think about that? I mean, you can respond to Marie-Louise, but I want to put it a darker edge too. You can take your pick.
I am absolutely opposed to picking some people and letting them have more children and saying of other people, you need to have fewer. It makes no sense to me. Of course, we know people have done that in a number of ways. It's always been terrible. I think one right we do have is a right to equal respect. If we want the human race to go on, and I certainly do, the most egalitarian way to do that is to say one child per two people, per couple, and not to say you're fit, you're not fit. There's no way of doing that.
Yeah.
So Sarah, I want you to imagine this. So you're addressing the United Nations. Maybe you bicycle down from Bowdoin. I don't know how you get there. So everybody's there and listening, and you know, the Pope and the Dalai Lama are participating via Skype. Every important person from all over the world is there. And you've convinced all of them of the impending disasters of population and the virtues of population control. But now for the second half of your speech, you've got to recommend practical, politically viable measures fair to both rich and poor nations. So that's an easy assignment. Tell us what you're going to say.
Well, as I've said, first I would press for education on the actual dangers of overpopulation and of what the projections are and our ideas of what that would mean. Second, and the Pope may not like this, I am really for the availability of contraception. We know it makes a huge difference. The American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, for example, has argued that birth control pills should be available over the counter rather than just through a doctor. And if that were true, many more people would use them, especially young people, if they didn't have to go to the doctor. I'd want contraception free and locally available. Three, as I've said, I think that what we need is to do things with money. That is, at present, you get a tax break if you have a child in the U.S. I don't know what policies are everywhere. We could reverse that, you know, give a tax break to people who have only one child or no children. We could have a tax penalty for having more than one. Practically speaking, that might be the same, but it would sort of express a social disapproval of having more than one. And lastly, I think we could just say there are straightforwardly going to be fines for people who have more than one child, if we have to do that. It's never the best idea. We all wish people would do the right thing without any sanctions involved. And in fact, most people do the right thing without any sanctions involved.
But a lot.
But there are people who don't.
A lot.
And so having a sanction like a penalty, which I would make on a sliding scale, so it's just as painful to the rich as to the poor, is something that could in fact be useful.
So Ed in Berkeley's on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Ed.
Hi. What I see is that this evolution is kind of not for, or natural selection is not for us in this case. The people with less education and less means to support the kids usually have the kids, and as a consequence, the kids are born poor and less educated, and then are not aware of the problem and have more kids. This is compounded by the fact that you've got automation is coming by. I understand some German factories are can be completely automated. So we're coming to a point where we're not where the excessive population that's being created is going to be unemployed. And when you add a couple billion people that are unemployed people as well. I mean, these two curves are squeezing us in the middle. The one is people have children when they don't have money or education and pass that lack on. And then the second is that these people will not have jobs properly.
Well, Ed, you said a lot of things, and a lot of things. One day I want to do a show on what automation is going to do to human labor. There are some people believe that the day is coming when there will be no labor left for humans to do. It will all be machines, and that's a scary thought in many ways. But I want the education and the wealth, those don't have to be. Those aren't genetically passed on. Nobody's born with an education, right? Nobody's born owning money. They're born to parents who are educated or not, and they're born to parents who have money or not. But there's no reason that those have to be transmitted. We have right social policies that guarantee education regardless of circumstances of birth and guarantee a decent living regardless of circumstances of birth. But I don't want to get on my lefty high horse there, Sarah. So you want to respond to Ed in any way?
Well, I agree with you. This is not a problem of a particular class any more than it's a problem of a particular culture. We're all in this together, and we're all contributing to the problem. It is true, again, there are some people who don't have access to contraception, in which case they're in a special situation because they can't help having more than one child, and we should allow them access to contraception. But beyond that, no, it's not a little these people are doing it or those people are doing it. We're all doing it.
But Sarah, in Ed's, the undercurrent, I don't think Ed intended this, but the undercurrent of what he, that's the thinking, again, I'm reading with my wife this book, that's the thinking that got the eugenics movement going. So certain social classes are reproducing rapidly, and we have to do something about that, and we want the people, we want the human kind to flourish, and they were willing to take these radical measures to do that. I mean, so there is a, I'm not saying you're advocating that, but how do you stop that line of thinking from making a comeback once you start down this road?
Well, I think we have to stress we are not trying to improve the human race as the eugenicists were. We're just trying to preserve the human race with the opportunities similar to those we have now. So it's not about producing better people. It's about producing fewer people. Could this policy be misused? Well, it would no longer be this policy.
Right.
I mean, of course, for all we know, any government could get in power and do all sorts of horrible things and pretend they were doing good things. But that's nothing that arises from what I'm arguing.
I definitely agree with that. I wasn't trying to pin that on you. But Marga from Oakland's on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Marga.
Thank you for taking my call. I just wanted to say that I went to a child care certification program with some women who had done that in China. And they were so against their country's one-child rule because it said it made little monsters because the children did not have a chance to have learn sharing and empathy, and all of the cultures, grandparents and aunts, all focused on the one child. So the child didn't have a chance to grow up healthy and to be a full human being.
Oh, you, Marga. So why don't you respond to this briefly? Sorry, this is the last thing we'll take from you. But, I mean, are single children psychologically worse off and morally worse off than multiples?
No. There's been a lot of study now of only children, especially there are a lot of them now, not just in China, but everywhere. And not surprisingly, the biggest difference in what makes a child a well-developed or ill-developed is the parents. So you could really spoil your child. You could really isolate your child. You could really pressure your child. Or you could not do those things. And there's nothing. I mean, there's really been a lot of studies. That's an old-fashioned prejudice that only children will somehow be, monsters. It's just not the case.
And actually, it turns out in these same studies, it shows that some people are really, really damaged by sibling relationships, and it kind of balances off, right? Like you said, there is lots of research about this.
So my own view, however, is that it's second children that account for all the progress in the world. So just a quick question. So suppose we revise this to two-children policy. Give people a fighting chance to have a girl and a boy. Combine it with a lot of education so that a lot of people would choose not to. Just would that come close to helping with the population problem?
Briefly.
Well, not immediately. I mean, at some point, of course, we could do that once we've reached a sustainable population. Unfortunately, because of what we've done so far, we're not at that point. But we will eventually. If we adopted a one-child policy, there's a point at which we could loosen it up again and have to.
Sarah, on that note, I'm going to thank you for joining us. This has been a great conversation, and you've been a great guest, so thank you very much.
Thank you guys so much.
Our guest has been Sarah Conley. She's a professor of philosophy at Bowdoin College, author of One Child, Do We Have a Right to More? Obviously, she thinks not. John, what do you think? Last closing thought.
Oh, I don't find rights very helpful concept. I mean, clearly we do have a right now because no government agency has taken it away from us and so forth and so on. I think a social policy, if we could implement it that in the long run said, you know, two children, that's you have a right to replace yourself on Earth as a couple, and then kind of say, but look, it'd really help if you just had one over the next 50 years so you get things into balance. I think it would be a wonderful thing. I'd feel much better about the world if we did that. But probably indirect things like women's education and getting our Congress to loosen up on our ability to help people around the world have birth control and getting the Pope to reverse the Catholic Church's position on it.
Lots of luck with that one.
Oh, no, it's not an ex cathedra pronouncement. It's not like abortion. They have wineries all over the world, and I think it's very inconsistent to say you can drink wine for pleasure, not just nutrition, but you can't have sex for pleasure, not just procreation. But people are telling me to shut up, so I will.
Yeah, well, nobody can shut you up, John. This conversation continues at Philosopher's Corner at our online community of thinkers, where our motto is cogito ergo blogo, I think, therefore I blog. And you, too, can become a partner in that community, and that's a very fun thing to do by visiting our website, philosophytalk.org.
Now, let's hear from a guy who always gives birth to at least one word too many. It's Ian Scholes, the 60-second philosopher.
Ian Scholes. When I was a boy, I had a friend from a family of 8 kids. Instead of milk gallons in the fridge, they had an enormous stainless steel bulk milk dispenser installed that poured milk from a spigot, the kind you used to see in restaurants back when everybody drank milk. I remember that giant milk machine and the fact that there were always Cheerios in the carpet, piles of clothes stacked everywhere, clean, dirty, who knows. The kids called their dad by his first name. And the mom seemed kind of vague, if you know what I mean. Even after all those youngins, she still had not learned to delegate responsibility. My friend was the oldest, but he did nothing. Didn't take out garbage or pick up after himself or respond when called. He was like an entitled only child without the spoiled part. He never got what he wanted, unless milk counts. He slept in a bunk bed in a room with 5 siblings, coated in Cheerios and smelling like stale cheese. And where was Dad? Not there much. As a matter of fact, he finally dumped the whole family and took up with a secretary, a woman half his age, and no kids. So you might say, he learned his lesson. One problem with population control is that the shrinking world is still big and kind of bulgy. That is, overpopulation is a problem in some places, but not in Utah, say, where big family Mormons are still fertile, and groceries still available by the truckload. And overpopulation has always been considered cute, as far as pop culture goes. Cheaper by the Dozen, The Brady Bunch, The Partridge Family, 19 Kids and Counting, which ran for 7 years on TLC. The big appeal of that show was logistics. How do you get all these people from one place to another? By an old school bus. And they had hand-me-downs down to a science. Once a kid was weaned, the parents did not do any parenting. The oldest watched the next oldest, and so on down to the zygotes, who just rested in mommy's tummy until it was time. leaving the parents time to make more babies, I guess. Kind of a vicious cycle, if you ask me, but nobody ever did. So there are logistical issues with big families, but there's also wiggle room if you lose kids to typhoid, rheumatic fever, war, pestilence, fairy kidnappings, and so forth. You have enough left over to keep the dynasty going. That's the secret of the Kennedys and the Bushes and the Palins and the Yorks and the Lancasters and the Game of Thrones gamesters. I've read some editorials also wondering about the Clinton legacy. Is Chelsea a legacy? Don't you need scheming evil twins and wicked stepbrothers before you can have a true legacy? Those single children have their own issues. The helicopter parents worried sick that the full potential of their special snowflake will be lost forever if they stop fussing for 2 damn seconds. China mandated single-parent families because there are just too many people. But Japan has the opposite problem. Nobody's procreating. And the population will drop by half inside 20 years. So family planning goes both ways. You can plan not to have one, or plan to have a huge one, so we'll all have more kids not having jobs 20 years from now. What with global warming, overpopulation, fuel shortages, income inequalities, chickens are coming home to roost. Except we're having a chicken shortage as well, and we can't really afford our roosts. Do Airbnbs allow for chickens? Do they allow for children? Well, all our children grow up to be Uber drivers. Only job left 20 years from now, if today's any indication. I gotta go.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of Ben Manila Productions and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University, copyright 2016.
Our executive producer is David Demarest.
The program is produced by Devin Strolovich. Laura McGuire is our director of research. Dave Millar is our director of marketing.
Thanks also to Merle Kessler, Mark Stone, Erica Topete, and Ted Muldoon.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from various groups at Stanford University and the partners at our online community of thinkers.
And from the members of KALW San Francisco, local public radio, where our program originates.
The views expressed or misexpressed on this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders.
Not even when they're true and reasonable. The conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org, where you, too, can become a partner in our community of thinkers.
I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.
Overpopulation is a real problem.
Sure, overpopulation is a problem. That's why people should have lots of babies. Because one day, one of those babies is going to grow up and solve that problem.